What did a co-founder of Facebook learn about negotiating his stake in the social networking juggernaut? He learned that one conversation can hold both the best and still the worst of decisions. This week on Techonomics, host Jason Middleton speaks with Mark Zuckerberg's former roommate, and that chat starts now.
Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. It's been a minute since we've touched on one of the recurring themes on the show, universal basic incomes. That's when citizens of a country or a city or some jurisdiction receive a monthly stipend from the government. That's where any agreement pretty much ends when it comes to what exactly the best approach to UBI is. How much a month? What are the thresholds for the recipients, like annual income? And here we go. Who pays for it and how? Chris Hughes has spent his career working at the intersection of politics and technology. He was a co-founder of Facebook, a digital architect for President Obama's campaign, and the publisher of the digital and print magazine The New Republic. And Mr. Hughes has a new book, Fair Shot, Rethinking Inequality and How We Earn.
We know cash works, and we know that jobs are becoming increasingly unstable in the economy. And we also know that we can't afford this today. So we should start with a guaranteed income of about $500 a month for everybody who's making $50,000 or less, and then build on that foundation if and when mass technological unemployment actually arrives in 2025, 2030.
In 2016, Hughes co-founded the Economic Security Project, a research program to explore how to provide financial security for all Americans through cash transfers. Here's our chat about his version of a universal basic income for Americans.
Chris Hughes, co-chair, Economic Security Project.
And author of Fair Shot, Rethinking Inequality and How We Earn. And I thank you so much for coming in today. I know book tours can be a little bit grueling, and I'm going to try to give you some questions that you haven't had to answer too many times before.
Sounds great.
But having looked through the book, and given where you've landed on universal basic income, which will be the bulk of our conversation, you had a conversation early on. It was a rainy night and whatnot, and I wonder if you could just relay that one more time for us so we can get some foundational aspect.
Well, in the book, I talk a little bit about this conversation that I had with my sophomore year roommate in college, who happened to be Mark Zuckerberg, a couple months after we launched Facebook. So Facebook was launched in February of 2004. And a couple months in, it had exploded in popularity, and it was becoming increasingly clear that it was going to be a real business. So Mark and I had this extended conversation that seemed to last forever on AOL Instant Messenger, which was the preferred method of communication at the time. And then we continued it in a walk in the rain. So I won't take you through the whole story, but, you know, we ended up having the kind of equity negotiation that a lot of co-founders have. I say in the book that, you know, I started off asking for 10%, ended up with 2%, and it made that conversation both a spectacular failure of negotiation and the most successful one, at least financially, in my own life. I mean, that very small portion ended up being worth nearly $500 million when Facebook went public later. And the reason that I wrote the book is to say, yes, I worked hard for 3 years at Facebook. I did product, marketing, and communications. But the financial reward that I got was entirely disproportionate with the work put in. And I don't think there's anything else that you can call it but a lucky break. But I also think that my case is, while it may be extreme, is not that uncommon, and it's indicative of what's happening in the economy, and it's what brings me to fight for the guaranteed income today.
Right, and specifically your story is a little more common in these 9 counties around where we're sitting right now, too. But I get your point that it was a quote-unquote lucky break, but maybe the compensation was disproportionate to the effort put in, which brought you to Fair Shot. So let's leap ahead. Let's skip past what you describe in the book about not being tax savvy and getting out at certain times in different rounds of funding and things like that. That's a typical stubbing of a toe, I would think. But when it comes down to universal basic income, what's your working definition of it? Since it's been around for a long time, I mean, I went back to Thomas Paine to look at some of the earliest examples. But the 20th century, it's had some peaks and valleys of interest. What is your interest here and what is your definition of it?
Well, I come to it because I think that the economy that is creating all of these lucky breaks, to use my case as one example, is very much something that we have chosen. You know, we tend to act like the economy exists in the background and we're just sort of riding the waves, when in reality, we've structured the economy to make it possible for a very small number of people to do very well. The top 0.1% now owns as much wealth as the bottom 90% combined. So I came at this originally through the lens of philanthropy. So my husband and I made a commitment to give away the vast majority of this wealth in the course of our lifetimes. We began a journey to figure out how to do that. And the journey in many ways led to cash, not as a silver bullet, but as the most effective thing to help people help themselves. We began internationally and then increasingly domestically. So my view is a little bit different from some of the other folks in Silicon Valley. I think artificial intelligence and automation very well may destroy jobs in the future wholesale. To be honest, we don't know. What we do know is that they've already completely scrambled what work and jobs look like in America today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the past 10 years, we have created jobs, by the count of Princeton economists, 94% of them are part-time, contract, temporary. I mean, Lyft drivers are kind of indicative of the gig economy, but it's much bigger than that. It's a 25-hour worker at Starbucks or Walmart as well. These same people don't have the same kind of economic stability that a job used to provide, 40 hours, benefits, vacation, et cetera. So my view is that we know cash works, and we know that jobs are becoming increasingly unstable in the economy. And we also know that we can't afford this today. So we should start with a guaranteed income of about $500 a month for everybody who's making $50,000 or less, and then build on that foundation if and when mass technological unemployment actually arrives in 2025, 2030, or even further in the future.
You point out in the book, too, that income inequality or disparity is the greatest it's been since 1929. Of course, after the Great Depression came a wave of progressive ideas. You may be familiar with Henry Wallace.
Of course.
And, of course, Roosevelt as well. But I'm wondering, when it comes to income disparity here, have you seen an example work? I know there have been some working examples in Finland, perhaps. Y Combinator's doing one over in Oakland right now, too. Mm-hmm. So when you were researching your book and honing your ideas around it, did you find any reasons for real hope?
Hundreds. So there's a lot of evidence internationally around the power of cash, literally hundreds of studies that show when you provide people with cash, they tend to invest in themselves, their health outcomes improve, education, they work just as much, if not more than before. But there's actually a lot of evidence here in the U.S. And this is one thing that I think often gets overlooked in the conversation around UBI or guaranteed income. We tend to go to Finland or Kenya or even up in Ontario where they're running a massive thing. We actually ran half a dozen pilots in the 1970s in the United States in places like New Jersey, North Carolina, where I grew up, Iowa, Seattle, Denver, Gary, Indiana, and over 10,000 American families received a guaranteed income, and we know quite a lot about what happened. I mean, they worked just as much after getting the benefit as before, with the exception of young mothers and people on the cusp of retirement. And we know that health and education outcomes improve. The same thing goes in North Carolina, where the Eastern Band of Cherokee has a small guaranteed income. And we could talk about similar results up in Alaska. There's a lot of evidence that shows, perhaps counterintuitively, that cash helps people help themselves. The hard part, I think, and what we have to think more about as a community, is how to develop the political will to really make the case for trust. Because at the end of the day, it does ask fundamental questions. Can, on balance, you trust people more often than not to invest money smartly in themselves and their families? And that, culturally in America, is a big open question. And so I think in many ways, yes, we need more research. And the Y Combinator work and the work the Economic Security Project is doing in Stockton will bring us there. Yes, we need to think more about policy on how to get this done. We can talk about the EITC and some other methods. But the big question is, how do we build the political will around this idea? And that's the kind of thing that people who are listening to this, everybody's got to pitch in to get done. Because without that, I don't think the idea will necessarily reach the fruition that we want it to have.
You know, in the conversations we've had for a couple of years on this show with different people sitting in that chair talking about UBI, I find it has been a polarizing subject, but weirdly polarizing, where like either really progressive people are arguing for it and really kind of independent people have called for it as well. And I've had some captains of industry tell me that the same thing, like I have to take care of my workforce as well. How does that mesh together, or does it replace those programs?
The role that I would like to play in this ecosystem, we'll see, is a bridge builder between pure futurists who think about a UBI at a cost of several trillion dollars and a lot of traditionalists, a lot of people is sort of, you know, symbolically are part of the think tanks in Washington, D.C., who are more skeptical, who like to focus on cash, but more like, you know, modest expansion. So in my view, we can build a bridge between people who are thinking about 2050 and people who are very focused on the political fights today. And here's how. We already have the largest cash transfer program in the world in the United States. It's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. It is technically a tax credit, but the lived experience of it is tens of millions of people get a check from Uncle Sam, mostly in the spring of every year, only comes once a year. And the amount can vary anywhere between $500 and $6,000. Mm-hmm. They can do whatever they want with that money. Lots of evidence to show that it's popular and it's effective. The popularity is on the left and the right. Every president since Gerald Ford, including Republicans and Democrats, have moved to expand it and have been successful in doing so. So my view is we have the framework in place. Now let's expand and modernize it. Specifically, let's increase it in size. Let's make it a flat amount of $500. Let's have it come monthly. So a total of $6,000 a year, but $500 a month.
So stability to it.
Stability. And let's extend it up to everybody making up to $50K. And then finally, let's make sure to expand the definition of work. Because right now, it's just tied to jobs in the formal economy. You got to go work at Burger King or in retail or somewhere to prove that you're working. I think there's a lot, and we know from the numbers, there's a lot of work happening in child care, elder care, study, and even further in the arts and elsewhere, religious work, that isn't covered by the definition. So I'm interested in expanding that definition. If we do those things, then what we end up with is a guaranteed income, an income floor in America for nearly 90 million Americans who could benefit. And I do think it should be paid for by the top 1%.
Okay. The math I did, you said 90 million right there. So I ran some numbers of 242 million at $1,000 a month. Okay, that came out to 2.7 trill. So let's take that down to your numbers, and I'm just going to ballpark it.
So we don't actually have to ballpark it. So the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy, alongside the California Center for Budget here, both groups have worked to get another layer of specificity of numbers. And so the total cost of what I'm talking about is actually around $290 billion.
Okay.
So an additional $290 billion. So let's be clear, that is still a ton of money. That makes it the fourth largest program after Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. It would be half the defense budget. It's also about what the Trump tax plan cost. So most estimates of the Trump tax plan over the next decade are about $2 trillion. This over the next decade would be a bit more than that. If you factor in the economic growth that major think tanks predict, more or less the same. Not exactly. But so my point is, this is a lot of money. But if we can develop the will to elect particularly Republicans in this case to lower tax rates on corporations in the 1%, then I don't think we should let anybody tell us that we can't, this is too expensive. It is ambitious, but it is also doable if we can develop the political will to do it. So specifically on how to pay for it, I think you should take taxes on income above $250,000 back up to where they were for much of the 20th century, 50%. And if you close some egregious tax loopholes, like the Buffett rule, for instance, then you've paid for this benefit. There are other ways to approach this. You could put a tax on carbon. You could do a tax on the financial system. I think that because inequality is so extreme right now, the problem should be tied to the solution. So I do view progressive taxation as the best way. But I also want to be clear, it is not the only way.
I'm a full-throated capitalist, and I assume you are too. I think that oxygen
with smart guardrails.
Okay, exactly. And that's kind of where I'm getting to, because it seems like the way the system has been working now and is gaining speed towards this, we're looking for a couple of trillionaires, maybe a few billionaires. I prefer thousands of millionaires, really. And I think that comes through a healthy middle class. That's been proven over and over again, right? Doesn't your program directly address the needs of the middle class?
I think so. I mean, my view is, you know, if you take somebody who's making $300,000 a year, which is a lot of money to many, but in our most expensive cities in San Francisco and elsewhere, I think a lot of people would say $300,000, particularly with the rising cost of housing, healthcare, and education. That's not the 1%. If you take folks like that, what we're asking is that they would pay about an additional $7,000 a year to provide a guaranteed income that would benefit up to 90 million Americans. You take somebody who's making $10 million a year, those folks would pay quite a lot more. I mean, it would take their tax rates up from 35% to 50%. So this is a little bit in the weeds, but I think it's an important point to make. Those folks would be paying over $1 million more a year. So my view is that we want an economy where there are plenty of winners, you know, where people can do well. There's an incentive for people to really reach for the top. At the same time, we don't want an economy that's a winner-take-all kind of economy. And I do think, both from the economic data and from lived experience, that the structure of the economy that we live in today, there is a very small group of people who are massively benefiting. So I think this is not – I say in the book, and it's become one of my most – it's become one of my favorite lines. This is not about pitchforks coming for the rich. What we know is that when there is broadly shared economic growth, as I think a guaranteed income would usher in, because if you provide people with $500 who are working to make ends meet, they'll spend most of that boosting consumer spending, mm-hmm. boosting economic growth. Over the long term, that builds the economy and causes it to grow faster. Mm-hmm. So it, over the long term, is a good thing for the middle class, for the poor, and I think for the wealthy altogether. And that's the kind of broad-based shared prosperity that we enjoyed for decades after the Second World War until really the 1980s when things began to come apart. And we minted a lot of millionaires. There were a lot of people right. who were very ambitious in that period. And so I think any idea that that would no longer be the case is a distraction.
Political will, you led with that. What are next steps for you?
So there's a lot to do on the demonstration front that's beginning. I'm hopeful that other cities will become engaged. There's a lot of policy work to do. How can we do this at a state level? Mm-hmm. How can we do it at a federal level? And then in the long term, how do we convene a national conversation really around trust and the power of cash to help people get ahead? I think that is going to take a lot of different people thinking about, well, what skills do I have? I think we need documentarians saying, okay, how can I tell the story of the resilience of people who are out there? I think we need artists who can paint public murals. I think we need journalists to cover the issue more in depth. And I think we need people to do what I think is often undervalued, which is just provoke.
A quick follow-up to that, because you mentioned enthusiasm among a certain cohort. What about enthusiasm or acceptance of a different cohort of, say, high net worth individuals like you? Are you seeing some traction there too?
I think we are. I think, you know, one of the reasons that I wrote the book was to start having a more honest conversation about the way work and wealth work mm-hmm. in America, how they're tied or not so tied in America today. And, you know, talking about money is awkward. People oftentimes sort of sidestep it. And we also tend to be like, oh, well, a few people over here get lucky. Everybody else over here works really hard. I think what we actually know, being honest about the way the economy is working today, mm-hmm. not just about how it might work in 2040, which is a little bit easier in some ways, but right. really focusing the conversation on today, I think, is what we have to do to get this conversation going in earnest.
Well, congratulations on the book. Congratulations on the momentum it's building as well.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Hughes, thank you much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Chris Hughes. His new book is titled Fair Shot, Rethinking Inequality and How We Earn. Hughes is also an investor and board member in several New York and California-based startups, and he graduated from Harvard in 2006, former roommate to Mark Zuckerberg. For links to Mr. Hughes and his think tank as well, the Economic Security Project, please check out the show notes for this week. They live at KGORadio.com. We also have an archive of all of our past shows there, and you can find the podcasts, well, wherever you pull down your podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, Audio Boom. A subscribe or a review would be aces if you have a minute. Coming up next, the battle for talent in Silicon Valley. The tech sector may be taking some heat in the public and political forum, but that has not dented the need for top-notch employees. We have a talent placement executive and thought leader in the tech space coming up after the break.
I mean, I think salaries are at an all-time high here in San Francisco, but they are also in Minneapolis. I mean, security is one of the things that probably the hardest roles to fill.
Okay.
There's just not enough people in that space with enough of a background.
I'm Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics. Please stick around.